Now, if you know me, you will know I am not a big fan of New Year's resolutions. For me, the pressure of starting something new in January has seen me fail over and over again. What I like to do instead is I like to give myself a little bit of time to settle into the year so I can actually figure out what goals I actually want to achieve. Now, one of my biggest goals this year is to be able to confidently speak in a new language, and this is something that I have been trialing and failing at, and also working at for a really, really long time. Fast forward to the end of 2024. Think about what you're wanting to achieve. What can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? Now, if you are like me, and one of your goals is to learn a new language, you absolutely need to get Babbel, and I'm so excited to chat to you about this. Now, in just a few weeks of using Babbel, I have progressed my language skills in ways that I have never done before. And I've been using Babbel's 10-minute lessons, which are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. What I love the most about Babbel is that it's designed by real people for real conversations. And I think this is something where I've gone wrong before. I have been learning French on and off since I was 9 years old. That is over a decade and a half now. Yet I still didn't feel confident in my communication. I was learning through textbooks, but I was actually lacking that human connection in my vocabulary. Babbel's courses have helped me to learn real-life conversation skills, to speak confidently and clearly in a way that locals will understand, as Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent too. It's enabled me to be able to order food, ask for directions, speak to merchants, all without ever having to consult my language app whilst on vacation. Now, studies from Yale, Michigan State University, and others continue to prove Babbel is better. One study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. Babbel has over 16 million subscriptions sold. Plus, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. Now, I actually have a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, you can get up to 60% off of your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/proverbs. Now, you can get 60% off at babbel.com/proverbs, spelled babbel.com/proverbs. Rules and restrictions may apply. Hello, you are listening to Proverbs with Daisy Maskell. It is me, Daisy. Welcome. This is a podcast all about extraordinary people and extraordinary stories. Here we will shine the spotlight on their journeys and hopefully learn something about ourselves and the way that we live our lives from their experiences too. Join me for the next half an hour as we get to know our guest. Welcome to the Proverbs podcast. Now, this is a story that I've been following on social media for quite some time, and it is of a guy called Jesse Crosson, who has just recently been granted a pardon from a 32-year prison sentence after serving 19 of those. We talk about how he has completely turned his life around, what life is really like on the inside, and his experiences with sharing a cell with a serial killer.
So I think we're going to learn a lot from this one. So at 18, Jesse Crosson was sentenced to 32 years in prison. Last year, he was granted a pardon and he was released and is now sharing his story of reform. And he's going viral on TikTok with every video. He's also chatting to us on this week's episode. Jesse, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How about yourself?
Good. I'm not too bad. Thank you so much for being here.
Of course. I mean, anytime somebody reaches out from across the pond to invite me to share my story, I'm really grateful.
Whereabouts are you based now, Jesse?
So I'm in Charlottesville, Virginia in the United States.
Oh, nice, nice, nice. And we always have to ask because us Brits always talk about the weather. What is the weather like where you're at right now?
We got 8 inches of snow 2 days ago.
Wow.
But here's the thing. It was 70 degrees. And then the next day we got 8 inches of snow. So I don't really know what's going on.
That is scary. That is global warming for you right there. I'm based in London and we're just waiting for it to snow. This is like our coldest time of year. But yeah, it just can't help. It can't help but rain. But no, yeah, I really appreciate you chatting to us, Jessie. I've actually seen a number of your videos that you've posted out just recently. You've been very, very busy. You're doing really, really well. And what I really respect about the videos that you've been posting out and just you as a person is your honesty and your openness about your experience and your journey so far as well. I think that is really something to be respected and admired as well. Do you mind starting off, Jesse, if you're comfortable doing so, just sharing what it was that you were convicted of?
Sure. So just after my 18th birthday, my buddies and I, we were strung out on drugs. We were kind of out of our minds and we were trying to figure out how we were going to get money. Like what were we going to do? How were we going to get more cocaine? And we had run out of ideas. And then one of my buddies had worked for this restaurant. And he said, oh, they're terrible people and they have all these things and, you know, they pay illegal immigrants under the table and then keep the cash. And so he kind of laid out this Robin Hood scenario that allowed us to justify to ourselves this absolutely unforgivable and terrible thing, which was breaking into their home to try to take things from them. And it turned into a robbery when we broke into the home thinking that it was empty and it turned out someone was there. So that changed, you know, from a break into a robbery. And then about a week later, one of my buddies was worried because his girlfriend had called and these two guys were harassing his girlfriend at home. And there was this big issue over drugs. And I ended up going to try to play hero. I got into an argument with them. I agreed to meet them. And I drove out there to meet him. And it was one of those few moments of clarity amongst the kind of like drowning of alcohol and cocaine that I said, you know, this is really not a good idea. Like I should leave. And I left and they chased me. And then as we were driving down the road and they were kind of like revving up their engine or like preparing to swerve into me, the passenger reached around like he was grabbing something. And I don't, he probably was grabbing a stick of gum, but in my mind, I thought he was grabbing a gun and I shot both of them. And they both lived. They both were able to pull off and go and, you know, seek medical help. But yeah, I mean, it was just an example of how completely out of my mind I was because I remember driving home from that, like everything blacked out, you know, I had fired the gun. And then all of a sudden the radio came coming back in and I realized I was streaming tears down my face and I went back to the house and I couldn't communicate. I had no idea how to explain what happened, like to talk. I was just completely out of my mind. And then I think it was the next day I got arrested and I remember feeling this tremendous relief because I had been so out of my mind. I'd been so out of control. And it was like, finally somebody had stopped me. Finally, there was like some end to this insanity because I didn't know how to stop it before that. I just felt completely, kind of on perpetual motion. And so it was this relief of, okay, you know, I'm arrested and, you know, maybe my life is over, but at least I've stopped.
So Jesse, take me back to the time you're 18 years old, which is so incredibly young. You know, you've got your whole future ahead of you. You've got a whole life ahead of you. And you hear that you're about to spend 32 years of your life in jail. What goes through your mind when you hear that sentencing?
Oh, I mean, I went completely numb. So there were two responses. Well, the first thing is, you know, the day I walked in for sentencing, the sentencing guidelines were 8 to 13 years, and then they were modified to 10 to 16 years. And my lawyer was like, look, you should take this. There's no point in fighting it. They're going to stick with it. Go ahead and take it now because the judge will probably remember the original sentence and you'll probably get the 10 years. Like you'll be good. And then they said 32 years. And it was this just feeling of kind of like a clenching in my chest. But at the same time, like I said, it wasn't a sharp pain. It was just a numbness all over. But there was also this other thing. You know, my whole life I had been kind of plagued by this feeling of, you know, being broken or inadequate or wrong. And this felt like a validation of that. It felt like, hey, this guy sees what a piece of crap I am. Like this guy sees that I'm clearly without value. And so there was this numbness and this kind of self-pity, but there was also this kind of validation of my worst fear. And it was like, well, I guess I am worthless. So it was kind of hard to explain. But again, that numbness lasted until I got back to the jail. We had these little AM/FM plastic radios you could buy for like $50 or something. And so I put the radio on because I didn't know what else to do. You know, I'd just been sentenced to 32 years and this song came on the radio and it just broke me. Just there was a lyric where he says, you know, when I die, dig my grave deep, dig my grave shallow so that I can feel the rain. And that was it. Like I just completely lost it and cried for like, I don't know, probably 20 minutes. And then I was numb again. And it was this transition of, you know, what is going on in my life? What is happening? And I had no idea.
I imagine as well, one of the most daunting times is when you actually enter in to that general population. And I guess that's sort of the first time that it hits you that you're going to be here for a while, for the foreseeable. Is there really a sense of asserting dominance beyond, you know, that numb feeling? Are you feeling scared? Are you worried for your own safety?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I was in the jail, I was fairly comfortable. You know, there were little fist fights or there were little kind of arguments, but it wasn't a big deal. When I went to receiving, it just had a different culture. It felt like the jail. It felt like a continuation of that. I mean, you did have people getting robbed and you did have violence, but it wasn't so prevalent that it felt overwhelming. But everybody had been telling me stories all the way from the jail and then through receiving that once you hit the real prison, once this happens, oh, then you'll see. Oh, it's so different. People had been building it up in my mind. And what was really surprising was the first day I walked in, it was just the same. It was just people trying to live their lives. If anything, it was more tranquil or more kind of calm. But I had so internalized that idea that I needed to, you know, make a point and I needed to, you know, prove something that I ended up getting into a conflict, I don't know, about a week after I got there and just got completely smashed. Like I got completely destroyed by something because I didn't know how to talk to people. I didn't know how to deal with conflict. I didn't know how to deal with things in a reasonable way. So I was actually the cause.
How long did it take you time to adjust? And how long did it take you time to sort of get into a routine where, you know, life inside just became normality to you?
I think I struggled for the first year or two. I got to the mainline prison after about a year and 2 months, something like that. And then once I got into the wood shop, I got a job in the wood shop, which was regular hours, was kind of consistent. That allowed me to kind of fall into a routine. I was in a place where I was, I got up and I went to work every day. You know, I went outside when I could. I had a structure and that began to feel like a normal life. Up until that point, everything had just been just so open and so unclear and so kind of ambiguous as far as time and opportunity and even what I was going to do. That structure really helped me. And that's one of the things that I realized throughout my whole bid is that a greater sense of structure really allows me a greater sense of freedom or relaxation or comfort.
And as far as the other men that you're living with and working with, do you all know what each other are inside for?
So some prisons have a culture of running papers on everybody and trying to find out their history. In Virginia, we didn't. There's kind of a new breed of people that are coming up. But when I went in, it was, you don't ask anybody about their crime. You don't talk about your crime. It was just, it was understood that you leave people be. If people want to volunteer something, that's okay. But otherwise, you just let everybody do their own time. And it's weird because some people would volunteer and some people wouldn't. But I had the experience, I don't know if this is what you're leading towards, but when I moved to that woodshop pod, I moved in the cell with this little old man that I thought was like a really nice guy. I was like, okay, this is great. And we got along great for about 6 months until my stepmom came back and was like, by the way, Jesse, your roommate's a serial killer. And that was a bit of a shocking experience. And strangely, we got along fairly well after that because of what am I going to do? I had an exchange with somebody this morning who was talking about it's so hard to explain to people that have never been to prison how quickly and easily you get comfortable with the fact that you're surrounded by murderers and rapists and robbers. And just that's the reality. You don't have a choice. So it really isn't a choice to choose or to decide to be okay with that. It's just inevitable. I mean, it's your daily experience.
You just answered my follow-up question, Jesse. So well done for being so receptive there. I did see you speaking about, you living essentially sharing a cell with someone that was a serial killer and you didn't know for a good 6 months until your stepmother informed you. How did that conversation go down when you confronted him about, you knowing about his conviction?
Well, so the backstory is that, I had felt bad because I was really fortunate throughout my whole incarceration. I had people that I could connect with. I had, I got mail. I was able to get on the phone. I was able to get visits. I had this tremendous support network, which allowed me to accomplish a lot of things that other people would have accomplished had they had the same thing. And I felt bad because he was this nice little old man who, like I said, he helped me tremendously. Every day he would give me like vocab assignments so I could improve my vocabulary. We used to watch Jeopardy together. Like there were things that he was genuinely benefiting my life. Like he taught me how to shave because I couldn't grow a beard when I first get in. And I didn't know about like shaving with the grain or against the grain or things like that. So when I said I would really like him to have somebody to talk to, and he had been stationed in Japan when he was in the military. My stepmom had lived in Japan when my grandfather was overseas doing missionary work. And so I said, well, maybe she would write and maybe, he could get a letter a month or something. This would improve his time. And so I asked her, and that was when she decided to kind of do her homework. And she came to see me at visit and said, Jesse, that your roommate's a serial killer. And then I had to figure out, well, how am I going to address this with him? Am I just going to ignore this? I had already told him that I was going to ask her to write. But I just figured that honesty was the best policy, as uncomfortable as it was. And I just said, hey, Greg, I got to talk to you. So you remember how I told you my stepmom was going to write you? Well, she looked you up and I can't remember the exact dialogue, but he just kind of laughed and said, oh, you did your homework, huh? And then he laughed. Oh, and it was just like creepy, dark. I don't even know how to describe it. It was really uncomfortable. And for the most part, the vast majority of our interactions were kind of light and comfortable and easy. And he had a sense of humor. But there would be these moments. Like I remember asking him one time about the FBI coming to see him. And he was like, yeah, they came to see me and they gave me a polygraph. And one guy just seemed to be convinced that I had beaten the polygraph and that I knew some things. And he started laughing that laugh again. And it was like, whatever this part of his life is that laugh is connected to, I don't want to know.
And then I guess you're sharing a cell with him. What do? You go and ask for a transfer and then have to, you know, live with him until you get taken to put into another cell? It's sort of, you know, I can imagine that the situation that you found yourself in, and sort of props for you for learning something and taking something out of that situation as well.
Continuing the conversation on Proverbs after this short break.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Did you ever meet anyone that you felt didn't deserve a second chance or couldn't be rehabilitated?
I met a few people. It's one of those things where I really hate, I hate the way or the dialogue that it often creates when I talk about this, because people like to turn it into a sweeping generalization of why people don't deserve a second chance. But I've met people that were so traumatized or so kind of poorly developed as far as, you know, some kind of trauma in their past, or maybe just wired the wrong way, that they were continually predatory, that they had been predators on the street, they continued to be predators in prison, that there appeared to be no way to break through. And, you know, obviously there maybe there's somebody out there that could, maybe there's somebody out there who kind of flipped the light switch of hope for them. But for those people that I saw, yeah, I would never want them out there with me or with my family or with you or your family. And I think they are the minority, but they're the tough bunch, because what do you ever do with those people?
And I'm assuming you also saw people that also turned their lives around just like you had as well.
Absolutely. One of my happiest moments out here in the world, I went to go meet with the governor a few weeks ago. He was doing a second chances thing to celebrate people who had turned their lives around, pardons he had given out, different things. And as I was walking up to the stage, I saw somebody sitting on the stage. The last time I had seen him, he was in prison. And I was like, wait a minute, that looks like UV. And all of a sudden, I mean, I just felt this like upswelling of happiness. And I get there and I give him a big hug and I go, what happened? Like, what's going on? And he said, oh, they pardoned me on November 19th. And that was my birthday. So this guy that I just care for and respect and just who's an amazing human being got pardoned on my birthday, and I got to see him again. And it was like to see people like him who had such long sentences, who had no promise of ever going home, but who were really good men, who really had worked their entire time to do something for other people, to do something for themselves, to see that recognized is just the most amazing feeling in the world.
And you know, the thing is, the purpose of prison and the purpose of jail is really for rehabilitation and to give people an opportunity to turn their lives around. So I think it's great when you see cases like that, and you know, when it's essentially done its job, you're out and about and you're living a life better and beyond, you know, what you were before you were even convicted, and you've learned so much about yourself along the way as well. So it's great that, you know, you recognize that there are other people and you've seen that there are other people that were in a similar situation to you, but have got themselves out of it as well. Did you come across any men that were innocent or that claimed that they were innocent?
Yeah. So there were two. While I was locked up, there was a man named Thomas Hainsworth who, after I believe 27 years, was found to be innocent. The DNA evidence not only cleared him, but actually implicated another guy that he had been locked up with. And that was the thing that, if you want to talk about a sense of betrayal, right? Like, not all prisoners have like a sense of, you know, identity or common purpose or whatever, but the whole thing is you don't stab each other in the back, right? Like, you have some kind of common respect for each other. And this guy had been in there with Thomas for all those years. And he had known that Thomas was in there for a crime that he committed. He was already serving a life sentence, or I think several life sentences. He was not going home. And he let that man sit in prison for 27 years instead of owning up to what he had done. And I just think that is the most unconscionable thing a person can do. And then the other story is a man named Robert Davis, who's local to where I am. He was in there for 11 years before the person who had actually committed the crime admitted, yeah, he had nothing to do with it. And then they went back and examined the case, and the police had essentially forced him to confess. You know, they had left him for 48 hours without sleep, without access to, you know, rest, without access to counsel. I mean, this was a guy who had some developmental disabilities, who was struggling in the most fundamental ways. And then they're going to basically use psychological pressure or torture to get him to confess to a crime that he did not commit. And thankfully, when he got out, they recognized, okay, maybe we shouldn't be doing this anymore. And they had some new standards put in place as far as the practice for interrogation. But yeah, he lost 11 years of his life for something he had nothing to do with.
How is time manipulated inside, Jesse? You sort of spoke a little bit about, you know, your coping mechanisms, but how did you sort of come to terms with spending? Because you did 19 years of essentially what was originally a 32-year sentence, right?
Yeah.
How did you come to terms with that? Did you have days where times or even years where, you know, time dragged? Did you have moments where things seemed to speed up? Did you have any sense of time? Did you count days?
The busier I was and the more structured I was, the happier I was. Okay. The most unhappy I was during that entire time was the 10 months that I was at a dormitory during COVID, where we were locked inside a room with nothing to do and nowhere to go. And I mean, that was horrendous. But when I had a job, when I could teach classes, when I could go exercise, when I could lead groups, like my time went by fairly quickly. I mean, I would look by and go, oh my God, it's, you know, it's been this long. And I wouldn't even realize it. But strangely, like one of the hardest times that I had was I figured out. So on that 32-year sentence, I had to do about 28 years with good time. When I figured out the halfway point of my sentence and I had that date, that was the only date that I ever counted. When I reached the halfway point of that sentence, I just had a complete breakdown because in my mind, I just could not possibly do that amount of time again. I thought it would be a celebratory thing. Like I'm halfway there. This is good to go. But I just collapsed. I didn't want to leave the cell for 3 days because I could not imagine myself basically spending another 14 years in prison. And I mean, I ended up recovering from that and I ended up trying to stay as busy as I could. And I had a lot of things that I could do. I had a lot of resources out on the outside. I reached out for things that I could volunteer for, jobs that I could do inside. I just stayed as busy as I could. And that really helped time to pass. But yeah, that halfway point and then the period where when COVID hit and we were just locked down and there was nowhere to go and nothing to do, that was pretty horrible.
How aware are you of the outside world as well, Jesse? Is it good to be aware of what's going on out there, or do you really have your own sort of sense of community and lives inside?
You know, the guys have a lot of different approaches to that. For me, I always wanted to know what was going on the outside. People would always say, well, what do you want to hear about or what do you not want to hear about? And I wanted to hear about everything because I never wanted to lose touch with the outside world to the point that I was only living for prison, because I watched a lot of guys become kind of professional prisoners. They were really good at hustling or they were really good at doing what they were doing. And they were only good in that environment. And were they to get out, there's a good chance they were coming back because they had learned nothing or they had no sense of what the outside world was. And I didn't want to end up in that position. At the same time, the hardest thing was when I got caught up in the drama of the world out here for things that I couldn't do. Remember when my grandfather was complaining they were going to charge him an exorbitant amount of money to put a roof on his house. And I was so frustrated and so angry at myself that I couldn't be there to help him put that roof on. Or it was something that was going on with my family and they just needed help. My mom, you know, had a property that was in really bad shape and she just needed help. And there's things like that were really difficult. But again, I tried to stay as aware I was of the outside world and never lose that as my destination. Because I think a lot of the guys that lost that as their destination ended up living lives in prison that just really weren't compatible with getting out one day.
Well, last year you were given a pardon and you were released as well. Do you remember the moment that you found out?
I do. So it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I definitely didn't expect that to happen because I had always thought that if you were going to get a pardon, it would happen, you know, first thing in the morning, or I'd heard of one guy where they'd got him right at lunch. And so it's 2 in the afternoon. I was going to try to sit down. I'd gotten a spot on the phone and I was going to go try to call my girlfriend and she didn't answer. And so the counselor came in, there was waving to me, and this was in the middle of COVID and I didn't have my mask on. And I figured she would make me put, she said, no, just get in here right now. And so I was worried because a lot of times when you get called to the counselor's office, that means, you know, somebody's died or some horrible thing has happened or you have to deal with, you know, whatever. It's usually bad news. But I got in there and she had this kind of look on her face and I didn't know what it was, but it made me have some sense of hope. And then there was a speakerphone. There was somebody on the speakerphone and they said, well, you know, Mr. Crossan, are you sitting down? And I said, no. And I just kind of felt this like building in my chest. And they said, well, because you're leaving Coffeewood today, you've been granted a pardon. And I just dropped to one knee and just started like screaming tears. And just, I didn't know how to process. It was almost like the numbness of when I'd been sentenced because it was so inconceivable, right? It was so unimaginable that I could actually get out before the 10 years, that the work I had done would be recognized, that the work I had done would be considered enough. Because how do you ever make up for the bad things you've done? I mean, I felt this horrible sense of struggle about whether I could ever do enough to make it okay, or whether getting out early would somehow like devalue the suffering of the victims in my case. Or I struggled with it. In that moment, it was magical. It was really amazing.
Mm-hmm. And how was it getting back to life on the outside? What was the first thing you did on the day that you got out?
So, yeah, I mean, they let me out that day. That was 2 o'clock. I walked out the gate at 1:30.
Did you have any idea, Jesse, that you were going to be given this pardon at all? Was this literally news to you there and then?
So I had filed in 2019 and I had filed with no expectation of it happening. I had a mentor who told me, he said, look, we can't control the outcome of anything, but the best thing we can do is the next right thing. And if once we've done everything in our power, we just have to let go of the results. So I filed the pardon under the hopes that at least when I spent the next, 12 or 14 years in prison, I could know that I had done everything in my power, that I hadn't, shortchanged myself, or I had not, taken any opportunity. And then it kind of built. I got some TV coverage for it. These things developed and it became, a possibility. And in February of last year, they called my mom and said, look, we just want to let you know that Jesse's pardon is on the table. We're going to look at it. There are no guarantees. We can't tell you what's going to happen, but we should hear something by the end of the year. So there was this hope that maybe I would hear something or things would go well. And then, in August, on August 16th, it just happened. And it was just kind of magical and amazing. And I don't really know how to put it into words.
Well, you've been out about 4.5 months. Do you find yourself doing things that were the norm inside that are just routine to you now?
The biggest one that's so hard, I mean, I have all these weird little habits, but the one that's so hard is I always forget to turn water off. Like if I'm cleaning the shower, I just leave it running. Or if I'm running the tap, I leave it running. And then I come back and realize I've left it on. Because for all those years, we had buttons that we pressed that automatically turned off. There was never a lever to turn things on. I mean, some of the habits, some of the kind of PTSD stuff about crowds, the fact that, my poor girlfriend, we had a date night and I was so sweet about it. I went and got food. I got it all set up. And then literally before she sat down, I was already like halfway through, if not all the way through with my food, because it was in the chow hall, you have to eat. If you're not eating, they're blowing the whistle behind you, yelling you to walk and talk. And it just, it was, there have been some lasting effects that have not been my favorite that I'm trying to deal with on a daily basis.
And how would you say that this entire experience has changed you, Jesse, whether that be for the good? What are some things that you feel like will stick with you for a long time or for the rest of your life?
I mean, there's undoubtedly some trauma or some kind of negative effects. But in reality, I went from being out of control, hating myself, hating the world, to being in a place where I am grateful for everything that I have, for every relationship that I have, for every opportunity that I have. I wake up and I can recognize how many options I have, how many amazing people I have in my life. I was unable to see anything outside of kind of my own, self-pity before I went to prison. And now I feel like I have a great sense of gratitude for everything around me. And then some of the practices I picked up, meditation was a big part of the kind of process of turning my life around. Getting sober was a huge part of turning my life around and actually having a support structure that I engage with regularly. And just learning, opening my mind to the fact that it's not just about me and my kind of primal, suffering or my primal desires or my primal whatever, because I live so much in my own head that it was horrible. I mean, that was probably the worst prison of all, because at least when I was physically in prison, but I could wake up in the morning and I could have a sense of gratitude, or I could connect with people, or I could do something meaningful for another person. I was free in that sense. And before then I was out in the world, but I was just as trapped as I could possibly be.
And I'm sure that this question you've sort of answered a number of times over the past decade alone, and I'm sure today it will have a very, very different answer than previous. But what are your hopes for the future now, Jesse?
Somebody told me a long time ago, it was some of the best advice I ever got, is that if you make plans, they can get sidetracked. But if you make sure you have options, then no matter what happens, you have a direction to go in. So there are a lot of things. I really fell in love with counseling and mentoring when I was in prison, and that's something that I want to pursue. Working with people one-on-one has just been the most gratifying, amazing opportunity of my life, because to watch that light switch of hope flick on in somebody, to watch those behaviors slowly change, to watch somebody finally feel a sense of agency or control or hope in their life is just the most amazing. And then on a larger scale, designing programming for mental health programs, maybe for schools or juvenile detention facilities or prisons, that allows me to do the same thing on a larger scale. And then I've really loved the opportunity of, being on this podcast and telling this story, or being on TikTok and telling a story, being asked to speak about this experience and speak about what is and isn't working in our system. Because I think so many people don't know, and be able to highlight that, because nothing gets changed if nobody talks about it. Nothing gets changed if nobody knows about it. And right now, public safety is not being well protected by the system we have. People are not being kept safe. There are so many things that are broken that we can address if we just take the time to talk about them. And it's not a partisan issue. It's not a moral issue. It's just a common sense issue. And I just love the opportunity to bring that into the public consciousness and hopefully, seek some kind of resolution or some kind of improvement.
I think there's a lot of power of you being a voice behind those things as well, because you have experienced this firsthand. You're a guy that has literally turned his life upside down and around, and, you've seen the benefits of doing so. So I think, I wish you all the best with that venture, because I think that would be an incredible move for you for sure. And we ask this at the end of every episode of everyone. What is your mantra in life, Jesse? What is the thing that keeps you going?
Yeah. I mean, it would be a deep breath. And I know that sounds like corny, or that sounds kind of, that's really what it was, is I realized wherever I am, no matter what's going on, I have the ability to kind of come back to where I'm at, to this present moment. And there is so much to be grateful for. Even in the middle of a panic attack at Costco when I first out, even in the middle of like emotional drama and strife and confusion, if I can come back to where I'm at, there's this great sense of possibility and love and connection that I never had any idea was possible. But it's never that far away. It's just right here if we stop to appreciate it.
That's a good bit of advice right there as well, Jesse. Just sort of taking time to be present within yourself as well and in the moment. I think we can all take something away from that. Jesse, thank you so much for this. I've really enjoyed this one. I really appreciate the work as well that you've done to better yourself. You know, no excuses, just full responsibility and a determination to right your wrongs as well. And I think that's really powerful. You've done so much to get yourself to where you are right now. And I think you should be really, really proud of that. Jesse, I genuinely wish you all of the best and keep on, you know, sharing your wisdom and keep on motivating people and keep on uploading your videos online as well, because I think that's doing a lot.
Thank you very much. I'm grateful for the opportunity.
And that concludes this episode of Proverbs with Daisy Maskell. That is me. I hope you enjoyed it. Hit subscribe so you don't miss out on any future episodes, and I will see you soon.